It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
I'm glad you're listening to episode 108 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. This week I have a great interview with Zohaib Awan, creator of Jinrise, and that's spelled J-I-N-N-R-I-S-E from IDW Publishing. We talk a lot about the book and how it came to be, as well as diversity in comics, something that really draws me in, and I think you're going to enjoy his talk with me. Then everything wraps up with news and previews. As always, there's lots to get to, so let's get on with the show. Talking today with Zohaib Awan, creator of Jinrise. How are you doing today, Zohaib?
Very well, Wayne. Thanks for taking the time today. And it's a beautiful way to communicate, Skype, isn't it?
Yeah, it's something. Of course, you know, I have to get new recorder. The recorder I've been using is going to go away as of the beginning of December.
Oh, wow.
So bad stuff. Anyway, nobody cares about that but us. But anyway, let's talk a little bit about the book that you've got coming out called Jinrise. Do you want to give somebody like the TV Guide explanation of what it's about?
It's funny. I've been asked this question many times, and it's amazing because when you're pitching something, it's always great to try to give a concise answer. So the elevator pitch, as it's called in the television universe, is... Mm-hmm. Genies versus aliens. That's sort of the way that I pitched Jinrise to IDW. But to be honest with you, it's not really Jin versus aliens or genies versus aliens. It's a lot more than that. For me, I wanted to tell a story that sort of dove into Middle Eastern themes in a very, very respectful fashion that reflected the cultural sensibilities of the region and really got into the mythos of that region, not the route that Disney went with respect to Aladdin and some other efforts that really sort of scratched the surface, but really dove into the genie mythos or the Jin mythos. And for me, having an antagonist like aliens was a nice way to sort of introduce the Jin or genie universe and give them an antagonist that they could go up against that would reflect the might of the Jin, the history of the Jin. And more than anything else, Jinrise is a story about Jin, but it's also about us as well. We'll get to that in a moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. You know, one of the things I always enjoy, you know, aliens always manage to come on either far country places or in big, huge cities, but we never get to see them in other countries. You know, Doctor Who, things always happen in London.
Mm-hmm.
And all these other things go all over the place. There was a book called Magician's Apprentice or something that actually had aliens arriving back in centuries ago in London. And I always found that to be something interesting. Just like what your book is doing is you're updating the legends and the stories. And I like that so much. It really makes a lot of sense. And I got a chance to read a promotional PDF of it. Great stuff. I really enjoyed the book. I learned so much just by reading it.
Thanks. And, it's funny, one of the things that I'm so happy to find from people when they've read the collected graphic novel is the appreciation of the research that went into the work. Because for me, going in, I felt that we really had to be academics, if you will. It was not going to be enough to just tell a story based on the common tropes and the common conceptions and misconceptions that we find here in the West. I wanted to make sure that we went to the sources in the Middle East to make certain that we were very, very respectful and reflective of the actual mythos and the actual history of that region. Because one of the most common misconceptions about jinn or genies is that they're like the genies in Aladdin or some of the other Western stories like I Dream of Genie, in which a jinn or genie can, you know, grant wishes and they can pretty much do whatever they want. In reality, jinn are very much in the fabric or in the storytelling legacy of the Middle East and that part of the world, and it's not necessarily because they're viewed as creatures of fantasy, but more importantly, they're actually viewed as actual beings. They exist. People in the Middle East believe that jinn do exist, that they exist in another plane of existence. They have certain powers and certain skill sets, but nonetheless, they are based in reality. They're not something that's just sort of drawn up in the mind of a fantasy storyteller or a storyteller of myth. So I really wanted to make certain that the jinn in our story reflected that understanding. So I really am happy that you are gaining a lot of, or at least some, information about the storytelling in that part of the world, but more importantly, the history of that part of the world as well, because that's something I really think is really something that needs to be addressed in a more, in a more sincere and academic fashion. But more importantly, it's something that cannot be done with just broad strokes. It can't be done in a cursory fashion. It has to really be something where we as storytellers dive full, head first, and do our best to make certain that we do our due diligence.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's always the case. And honestly, this isn't the first time that I've read a culture that I don't know about and I actually learned a lot about it. I don't know if you've ever heard of the book called Yi Sun Xin.
No, I haven't.
It's a book, Henri Campan, and I've actually talked with him. Mm. It's actually talking about in Southern Asia. There, this guy Yi Sun Xin was like a ruler, and he was also a person who understood strategy. And so there was a war going on, and he was in charge of it. Man, I learned so much about that culture from reading that book, and it's still ongoing. Mm. I hope to interview him sometime soon. But I get the same experience when I was reading your book. I get to understand more about what the culture is like. And how people think, and I always get a kick that in this book, actually, the Western child is actually, or the young man, is the person that we look at their culture through.
Mm-hmm.
So I really like that. But one more thing before I get to talk about him, I want to mention before I forget. When you brought up Disney's Aladdin, I had to say when I looked at the blue jinn, I thought, that's funny. I wonder if he speaks with the voice from that movie, you know?
You wonder if I were thinking about Robin Williams when I It's funny because I think often when you are reintroducing a myth or a particular storytelling staple to an audience, you want to sort of give them a sense of you want to give them something that they can latch onto. So maybe at a subconscious level, I felt it might actually make it easier for readers who have not really read that many, jinn stories to be able to hold on to something that they were familiar with. Because granted, it's not the jinn. Our jinn is not like the jinn in Aladdin, where Jabba is the farthest thing from Robin Williams' portrayal in the animated classic. But for Western readers, sometimes it helps to have something to latch on, to hook onto. And it's funny you bring that up, because I had this conversation with someone the other day about aliens in general in film, and George Lucas's cantina in Star Wars. And it's amazing, because I'm sure you've traveled to many comic conventions and you've talked to a lot of other creators and other mediums, but it's interesting that when you talk to them about their creative process, they have incredible imaginations, but they also have to at times rein it in a little bit, because if they make something too alien, the audience can't relate. So going back to the cantina in Star Wars, George Lucas consciously made a decision to make certain that the aliens in Star Wars were aliens that we could relate to. They weren't too ugly or too repulsive. They were anthropomorphic in many instances. So we could sort of relate to those aliens, not so much because they were alien, but because there were certain things that were very much common with human beings. So sometimes at a creative level, you have to make that conscious decision or subconscious decision to make certain that what you're introducing to your readers or to your viewers is something that they're familiar with. Otherwise, you might even lose them at the outset. So, maybe that's what I was thinking going in.
Well, I hate to tell you, but I didn't like the way George Lucas did that sometimes, because he would often take stereotypes.
That's true, too. Yeah.
And I hated that. And I really have to give your book credit, because I don't get any of that stereotypical stuff going on.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. And it's funny, and I know we're going to get to that in a moment, but one thing I definitely want to make clear at the outset is that I want to make certain that this was a story that was told for a global audience. It was never my intent to tell a story for a Middle Eastern audience or for a Western audience, I've always viewed Gin Rise as a global myth.
Hmm.
And the reason I feel it's a global myth is that because at the heart of the story, and it's actually one of the first things that's introduced in the first issue is the notion that the game of life is about us all, wherever we are or wherever we're from. And for me, that is the central, central point or the central hook of the story. And for me, everything that comes from that seed has to reflect that heart. And, that's what I wanted to tell going in. How we tell the story, obviously it's going to, if you tell a story in China, it's going to reflect the cultural mores of that region. If you tell a story from the West, it's going to reflect those mores. But for me, I wanted to make certain that Gin Rise not only reflected Middle Eastern themes or had Middle Eastern flourishes, I wanted to make certain that the story itself was told in a fashion that a global audience would enjoy and appreciate. So you could take Gin Rise to Malaysia, you could take Gin Rise to Brazil, and the people in those parts of the world could relate to the story, even though it had Middle Eastern themes in it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was going to say that. You brought up a point that I wanted to make, was the fact that I felt it had a universal appeal to it, was that humans, no matter where they are on this earth, can relate to this story because there are things that you're using that are aspects of humanity that are common to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt that too, and I saw in your beginning to it a little bit about that, but I read the story first and then saw that, and so I was glad I picked that up before I actually read that you were trying to do that. But man, I thought that was such a nice book for everybody to read, you know. And I have to say this too, that this has an appeal for all ages.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you were a kid, you could read this. If you're an adult like I am, you can read it. There's a lot of good things happening in it, and there's so much good storytelling happening that I couldn't put it down. Once I started to read it, man, I was turning pages to find out what happened next, and I was like, when I got to the last page, and I'm not going to spoil what happens on the last page, but you bring up another legend that comes up. I was like, nuts. I have to wait for the next one. That's when I went on Amazon, and I noticed you've got another one of these coming.
Yeah,
hopefully before too long. So it's a great story, great fun, and it moves really quickly too.
Thanks. And, you know, it's funny. For me, that was probably the biggest challenge going in, telling a story for all ages, because obviously as an avid comic reader yourself, you know that most of the comic readers, or I don't want to say most of the comic readers, but the vast majority of comic readers probably skew older.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe between the ages of, I'd probably hazard a guess, between the ages of probably 18 to 35, if not older. I'm a longtime comic reader myself, but at the same time, I wanted to make certain that Gin Rise would be a story that the younger set would enjoy, and even people who had never picked up a comic book before would enjoy as well. And that was, for me, the biggest challenge, because trying to tell a story for everyone makes it that much more difficult, because you're not targeting a particular niche. You're not targeting a particular group of readers. You're targeting everybody, in a sense. And again, going back to Star Wars, and not to say that George Lucas has succeeded on every level, but I think one of the reasons why Star Wars succeeds so well and has continued to resonate with fans over the last couple of decades is because of the fact that it was a story that had little hooks that everyone could latch onto. If you were a 5-year-old, you could revel in the lightsaber battles or the space battles. If you were an older fan like myself, you could really get into the light versus dark elements of that story. And that's what I'm trying to bring to Gin Rise. I really tried to tell a story that was not too heavy in the sense that it would, chase away the younger crowd. But at the same time, I didn't want to dumb it down so that people like yourself and myself would be bored and feel like, oh, you know what? This is just fluff. It's just a mishmash of subgenres, and I'm not really into that.
Mm-hmm. Well, for me, I never felt like you were talking down to me, and I know a lot of kids who, honestly, we misjudge kids today if we think that they're not going to pick up a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because with all the technology and all the reading and all the stuff that's available to them, a lot of them actually can pick up a lot more than we think they can.
This is true. This is very true. Very true.
So I was appreciative that you didn't talk down to neither me or kids. So that was a great thing about the book that I really liked.
Thank you. Thank you. And, you know, it helps to have great collaborators with you. And when you're working with, artists like Andrew Huerta, who is doing just an amazing job. And if you thought the first five issues were great, he worked on the final two issues in the trade. But if you think those issues were fantastic, the last couple of issues, 8, 9, and 10, for me, it's just jaw-dropping stuff. And I can't tell you how excited I am every time I get an email from Andrew, or there's a page dropped in the Dropbox from him with an illustrated page from Jen Rice. But the last couple of issues are just amazingly strong stuff. And I want to say Tony Vassallo did a great job at the beginning of the series with Timothy Yates on colors. And the other thing that's great is working with an incredible writer like David Liss on the last couple of issues. His scripting on the last couple of issues. I wrote the first five issues, he just has done an amazing job in bringing my vision to life. And I just think that he's one of the most underrated writers working today. So when you're working with people like that, it makes your job much easier, I can tell you that.
I got a chance to interview him for this podcast a couple of years back. And, of course, he does The Spider, and he does some other good things like that, all of which are great writing, all of which are very solid storytelling, all great things. And so I always recommend whatever he's doing, and this gives me a chance to recommend another thing that he's writing, and that's this. He does such a great job of that and understanding the characters and balancing character and action.
Exactly.
You know, and that's what I think. You did the same, I thought, though. It was hard for me to tell when he picked up after your writing, so that's a good thing. I thought that you guys are working well together and making good things happen.
Oh, yeah. And like I said, I think David is such an exceptional writer, and he's an incredible novelist as well. As a matter of fact, I actually host a radio talk show in Philadelphia entitled Fictional Frontiers. I've been doing that for about 5 years, and we cover a little bit of everything with respect to genre entertainment. If people want to listen to our show, it's at www.fictionalfrontiers.com. We actually just started we're an AM radio show, actually, but we actually started a podcast with the guys from Rebel Force Radio, and they're going to be doing Fictional Frontiers podcast every week. We're going to be taking some of our best segments and putting those on there. But I actually met David through the radio show, and it was not about comics. It was actually about his novels, because like I said, he's an exceptional novelist, and his work on historical literature is actually where he made his name. It's actually where he became a writer of note. And then he jumped into comics, and like you said, his work on The Spider was exceptional. He's got a great Moriarty series coming out from Dynamite very soon, and I just snagged him as soon as I could, because I felt like he was one of the few writers working today who could really, really balance, like you said, the action with the more thoughtful segments. And I'm just so happy that he was working on Gin Rice, and hopefully he'll be collaborating with us on future efforts as well.
That'll be good. I'm looking forward to it, because it just felt so good. Now, I do have to say about the artist, the art was great. Even when it switched a little, I guess somewhere in towards the end, you got a different artist involved. And I liked them both. Both the artists to me seemed to capture the thing. The first one was very dynamic and covered a lot of ground and made things literally pop off the page. As the story got more serious, though, we had this other artist who had a little more serious tone to it.
Exactly.
And I thought that he did a good job on that, too. So, you know, I think that you guys are flying high right now. It's great stuff.
Thanks. And it's funny, I think you nailed it exactly as far as the art team is concerned, because Tony, the way I look at the first half of Gin Rice volume as sort of being our Fellowship of the Ring, if you will. We're trying to, establish the world, get the basic parameters laid out, and I think Tony did a fantastic job in starting the journey forward. But then, as you mentioned, as we get darker and as we move, I don't want to say darker, as we actually become a little bit more serious in our storytelling, I think Andrew Huerta, took the baton and ran with it. He actually really took it to the next level, because just like The Two Towers and Return of the King, the Peter Jackson films, the world becomes much denser, and it actually requires an artist. We needed an artist who could really take us to different parts of the world. And, I'm trying to avoid spoilers here, but in the next five issues of the series, we go to different parts of the world. So we don't stay in the Middle East. So we needed an artist who could take us to Greece, who could take us to China, who could take us to the farthest reaches of our world and could reflect the cultures of that world. And that's why I think Andrew is perfect for that, because it wasn't enough just to have action set pieces. We really wanted to make certain that the backgrounds were really strong as well. And if you notice, in many comic books today, a lot of the backgrounds are sort of neglected and they're just sort of barren. And I'm not criticizing those efforts. I'm just saying that's just sort of the way comics are drawn today with respect to many mainstream books. And I wanted to avoid that. I wanted to make certain that the story, as it moved forward, actually brought you into those places, took you to those places. It became more of an immersive experience versus just, you know, bang, bang, shoot, shoot, action, action, fight, fight. And I wanted it to actually be an immersive experience versus something that was very, very, I guess the best way to put it, I didn't want it to be something that was simple. I wanted something that was very, very complex in tone and in storytelling. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you really accomplished that, particularly with the genies. I mean, we've got social structures within the genies that I've never seen anything like that before. It's always the genie does one genie with one thing. That we've got two genies, and they actually have conflict between the two.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we find there's a whole culture in which the genies survive and things like that. I really like that because I'd never thought of that before.
Right.
That was something new and startling to me. And I said, wow. I said, I've always only seen one genie at one time, and that's it. So where did that idea come from?
It actually came from I think the idea came from a question. The question was, where do these genie bottles come from and how do they work? Mm-hmm. And obviously, like I said, we were trying to bring a sense of the real to the genie mythos. So we were trying to reject some of the common tropes that we find in Western myths with respect to djinn and genies. But for me, I always thought that the genie bottle was an interesting element that was added to the genie mythos. With the stories in the Arabian Nights and Aladdin, I always felt that the genie bottle was, when I read the Arabian Nights and I read the stories about Aladdin, the first question that came to my mind was, where do the genie bottles come from and how do they work? So for me, when I decided to tell a story about djinn and aliens, I said to myself, you know what, I'm going to explain where the genie bottles come from and how they work. And that was my goal going in with respect to the djinn or genies in this story. And from that, all of the culture of the djinn sort of emerged. And it's amazing how the creative process works, because you go in with certain notions and certain ideas, and then if you allow yourself to organically allow the process to flow forward, you'll find that amazing things can develop. And that's what happened. I said, you know what, we're going to address where the bottles come from and how they work, and we're going to allow those questions to lead to other questions, which will allow us to establish the djinn or genie world. And for me, that, you know, and again, I'm trying to avoid spoilers here. Mm-hmm. In the last issue of the series, we actually explain where the bottles come from and how it's completely tied into the history of one of our characters. And that character in there, the Green Djinn or Green Genie in that series, is actually my favorite character because, you know, he's got ties to the human world, he's got ties to the djinn world, and his story is a very tragic story in many respects. Mm-hmm. So my favorite character is Dayuk, the Green Djinn, and it all sprang from those questions. So sometimes the best stories come from asking questions.
Well, I always like to ask, what if?
Exactly.
What if is a great question, because what if this happens? What if that happens?
Mm-hmm.
And then all these different stories come rolling out because of that.
Mm-hmm.
I find it interesting you made him green as opposed to blue, which the main one is. was that to visually differentiate them?
Well, it's funny because, again, going back to my desire to create a complete – or actually go into the djinn culture or the djinn societies and again, I guess this is sort of a mini spoiler, but not too much of a spoiler. In the djinn culture, the genie culture in Djinn Rise, the djinn are broken into broken up into different guilds or sects, if you will. The djinn in most of the djinn stories here in the East and in the West, particularly in the Middle East, they have certain powers. They have certain skill sets. So in my story, the djinn in the djinn cultures in Djinn Rise, they choose to be part of particular guilds or particular societies. So, for example, Jinn are known to have very strong. Some Jinn are known to move very quickly. Some Jinn are known to be masters of flight. So for this story, what I wanted to do is I wanted to have different guilds in which Jinn members would perfect that particular skill set. So if Jinn were known to be strong, there was a particular sect that would be the strongest. If a certain sect, if Jinn were known to be able to move quickly, there was a particular sect that could move very quickly. Mm-hmm. And each sect would be represented by a particular color. Mm-hmm. Now, Dayuk, who's the green Jinn, mm-hmm. He was actually known to be a very skilled person when it came to the manipulation of his body. And there are scenes in the story in which he can change his size, he can change his shape. So that Jinn sect that he's a member of or part of is actually a Jinn sect that has perfected the art of changing shape and changing size. And all of the Jinn in that Jinn sect are green in color. So that's why he was green. And unfortunately, in the 10 issues, we really haven't had a chance to go into those particular sects in great detail. But as the Jinn mythos, as the Jinn stories continue, and that's the plan for Jinn Rise, we wanted to establish the world, we wanted to tell other stories. We'll definitely go into more detail with respect to that as we move forward.
Well, the reason you can't get too involved with the Jinn sects is the Kibrani, the aliens who attacked. Mm-hmm. What was the idea for the Kibrani? I mean, compared to like other aliens that we've seen in fiction before, mm-hmm. what did you want to accomplish with the Kibrani?
Well, again, the Kibrani actually, what I want to do with the Kibrani is I wanted to address the notion that might does not necessarily make right. The Kibrani are obviously very skilled warriors. They believe that basically manifest destiny lies with them because of their strength, because of their prowess, physically, strategically, militarily. And for me, I wanted to reject that notion. So for me, they represent everything that is wrong when it comes to determining whether or not a person or a society has relevance or has a sense of superiority. Basically, what makes a society superior is the notion of their character. Character comes before anything else. That's the most important thing with respect to society and the individual, in my opinion. And the Kibrani are completely opposite of that. They believe that if you're physically stronger, if you are militarily stronger, if you have the might, then that makes the right. And what I wanted to do with them was to have them serve as, like I said, the antagonist, and to actually demonstrate through the story, or actually illuminate through the story, the notion that might does not make right. And that's where I came up with that notion. And interestingly enough, the word Kibrani actually was derived from the word kibr in Arabic. And kibr it means arrogance. And so the Kibrani actually, their name comes from the word arrogance. And if you notice in the designs of the spacecrafts and some of the ships, they are so infatuated with themselves that they even design their ships to sort of look like them. they have, and again, it's almost as if they're trying to say, look, we're not only going to defeat you, we're going to make certain that we're going to rub your noses in it as well. And to me, that's the epitome of arrogance. That's the epitome of a wrongful notion of superiority. Mm-hmm. And on the flip side, you have Eunice, who is the poorest of the poor, who's a simple, a simple boy whose uncle works in the marketplace in Morocco, a boy who was taught from a very young age that, look, things happen for a reason. You may not think that you have much worth, or you may not think that you have much wealth in your life, but believe me, if you hold on to noble character, then you're the richest of the rich. And not only that, at some point, there will be a time in your life where you will make a difference. Mm-hmm. And that's where that contrast lies. That here's the poorest of the poor against the mightiest of the mighty, and it's a story that we know where it's going to go, but how we tell it obviously is where the fun is. But at the end of the day, what I want people to take away from Jinn Rise is that again, the game of life is about us all, wherever we are, wherever we're from, and even the smallest person mm-hmm. or the quote-unquote most insignificant person, or the person that we think may be insignificant, may actually be the key to everything we hold on to, or the key to whether or not we succeed on a micro or macro level.
Mm-hmm. Well, I loved when the Cabrani showed up, and the leader says, "Why, these people are so unorganized, they need me in charge." And I hate to tell you, but it reminded me of certain folks in our society today. And I thought, you know, I don't know if you actually wrote that to be that way, but I thought, you know, this has modern applications.
It's funny, as some readers have brought that up before, and I didn't consciously want to reflect any particular society today. More than anything else, again, it was just the notion that material wealth or material strength, it can delude people into believing that they are superior to others. Mm-hmm. And that they, because of their wealth, because of their wealth, a lot of times they become deluded so much so that they believe that they could do a better job in controlling the destinies of others and even the individuals themselves. That, you know, I have money, I have strength, I have power, I know better than you. Mm-hmm. And that's the notion I wanted to bring to the mix. And that's something that actually has existed for, since the dawn of time. It's not something mm-hmm. that's emerged in modern times. It's happened many, many times in the past as well. Even if you go as far back as, you know, Genghis Khan, if you go as far back as the Romans, if you go as far back as the Greek, every society has elements in there mm-hmm. that reflect that notion. Mm-hmm. And I'm rejecting that notion through this story.
Mm-hmm. Well, believe me, I get that, and I was very happy to see that, because I don't think just because you have authority, that means that you can't be questioned. So
exactly.
Anyway, why don't we talk about the humans? I mean, it's interesting. We've been talking a little while, and now we're getting to the humans, because the djinn and the aliens and all the and everything that's going on is so interesting that we need the humans, though, so that we can relate to them as well.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Marcus, where did he come from as a character? He's kind of the one that we're looking at everything through.
Right, right. Well, Andrew Marcus, he sort of represents the typical college student that I experienced when I was in college. That was 20 years ago. And I would probably put myself in that mix as well. I don't think he represents a particular culture. He just represents a naive mindset. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, if I look at myself, and like I said, I think I had that mindset as well. I was blessed to have come from an affluent family. And I went to college and I experienced the college lifestyle, and I thought, life is just about, you know, worrying about the next test, or, you know, what movie's coming out, or what have you. I didn't really have a proper perspective of the real challenges that lay before other people in our world. For me, growing up with a quote-unquote silver spoon in my mouth, I really didn't understand that I was truly fortunate to be where I was, and that, you know, that just because I'm in that position doesn't necessarily mean that others are in that position as well. So for Andrew Marcus, he sort of represents that mindset, that naive mindset, the mindset of people who don't take the time to learn about others. And that's not reflective of a particular group or a particular society. I think it's reflective of us all, in a sense. Even Eunice later on, he has to come to grips with that as well. But what I wanted Andrew to experience in this story was the idea that, look, you know what? If I do learn about others, I can make a choice. I can either, you know, open my eyes and recognize the fact that there are people with different beliefs and different strengths and weaknesses, and they have different challenges, but they also have different strengths as well. I can open my eyes to that reality and embrace that, or I can run away from that. And what Andrew learns through this story, and he's the narrator in this story, and he's the one who actually comes to that conclusion about the notion that life is about us all, is that, like I said, that everything happens for a reason. People are put in a particular position because of something. We don't know what that is. It's funny. There's the notion of the butterfly effect, and I'm sure you're familiar with that. And it's a very common trope in time travel stories, that every little, even a butterfly can change the course of the future. And it's even reflected in stories like Lord of the Rings. Even the smallest person can change the course of the future. And I think that what Andrew learns through this story is that every person is important. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily have all the answers. And guess what? I didn't even know what all the questions were. But guess what? This adventure, this story, this awful time that I'm going through, because let's face it, when your school's blown up and you're betrayed by your best friend, your life, you learn a lot of things, not only about yourself, but about others. Andrew learns that life has a lot of different challenges and a lot of different possibilities, and that there are people in different parts of the world who are experiencing different things. And guess what? We all have to work together if we're going to ever overcome the challenges that we all might face on a global scale.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's the message that comes through the book, and I really like that a lot, because I think that's something we need more of, to be honest. Okay. So, well, the Eunice particularly fascinates me too, because he's got the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one that basically is in charge. And what I enjoyed between Eunice and the genie was that they had this really kind of friend relationship going on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, when we first see them, and they're kind of talking nasty to each other, and then there's silence, and then they laugh at each other.
Mm-hmm,
because
mm-hmm.
They were behaving like I kind of expected that they would.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, this was all a big joke to them. And I thought, you know, I can throw all that stuff right out the window, because this is very different from that. And I thought that was a great way to do it. I love to be surprised. I love it when things go a way I don't expect but still make sense. And that relationship between the two of them really stood out to me.
Thanks. And, you know, I think that the way I look at the two lead characters in Gin Rise, I like to compare them to the two lead characters in Shawshank Redemption. I think that Andrew Marcus is the Morgan Freeman character. He's the one who's telling the story. He's the one who's telling the story of himself and Eunice. And Eunice is the Timothy Robbins, the Andy Dufresne character.
Hmm.
And the relationship between Jubal and Eunice is actually the heart of this entire story. Because when you look at Eunice, if you could put yourself in the position of a kid, who would not love to have a super-powered best friend to play with, to protect? I mean, he's the ultimate bodyguard. That's sort of the way that he is to Eunice.
Mm-hmm.
And as the story progresses, actually, Eunice has to come to grips with some questions himself with respect to Jubal, because can you actually be a friend of someone if you are in control of that person?
Mm-hmm.
And as the story progresses, one of the other things that we are going to address is the notion or the idea of letting go. Every parent who has a child, they raise a child, they have a wonderful relationship with that child, but they still have control of that child. And Eunice has control of Jubal, even though it's a very friendly, buddy-buddy relationship. At the end of the day, Eunice is the master and Jubal is the servant.
Mm-hmm.
And what Eunice is going to have to come to grips with as the story progresses is the notion, what if I let Jubal go? Will he still be my friend, or will he leave?
Mm-hmm.
That's something that parents have to come to grips with as well when they're raising children. You know, you raise a child, you know, they go through middle school, they go to primary school, middle school, high school, and then they go off to college, and every parent has to, you know, come to grips with the notion, you know, what's going to happen after he leaves? Is he going to forget me, or is she going to forget me? Are they going to move on with their lives? Am I just going to be someone that they visit once in a while, or maybe call once in a while? Are they still going to be that loving son or loving daughter who's always there in my life? And Eunice is going to have to come to grips with that as the story progresses, because he does have a master servant. There's a master servant relationship going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope the reader asks the question as well. Can someone actually be a friend of someone if they are in a position of authority?
Boy, that'll be something. He's going to actually become a little more adult when he faces that question.
Yeah, he's going to have to. And that's another thing that he learns from Andrew as well, is that, you know, he is a very noble child, young man. He's a very pure young man. He's been raised with the best of character, but he also has some hang-ups as well. There's a scene in one of the issues in which he gets very angry at Andrew because he thinks that Andrew doesn't care about what's happened to his uncle and aunt. And that's not fair for him to come to that conclusion about Andrew either. So both Eunice and Andrew are learning from each other. Mm-hmm. And what I think that Andrew learns is that noble character is something that we should embrace. Sometimes you have to make sacrifices, even if it's not in your best interest. That's one thing that Andrew learns at the outset. And I think Eunice learns that sometimes you have to make hard decisions and everything is not black or white. Mm-hmm. So hopefully by the end of the story, they'll come to a happy medium where they both learn from each other and they realize that life is not really often black and white. It's often gray. And they'll mm-hmm. come to a happy middle.
Yeah, well, that's great stuff because, you know, a lot of comics don't get that deep, to be honest with you. It's mostly just punching and kicking and, you know, long things of dialogue going on that don't really have anything to do with the story. But, mm-hmm. man, you're telling a really great story, several of them involved in this gen, right? So that's great.
Thanks. And, you know, and the thing is, I didn't want it to be too heavy-handed and and at the same time, I didn't want it to be something that, like you said, was just fluff and just a bunch of action sequences. So for me, it was more important to plant the seeds for further discussion. You know, we introduce a certain notion here or there, and then I'll let the reader walk away and say, you know what, maybe that means a little bit more than I thought on the surface. And they can talk about that or think about that with their friends, but it's not going to bog down the story, and there's still going to be a lot of fun as we move forward as well.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that's great. I think that's the kind of storytelling I really enjoy. Particularly, so I'm really looking forward to more as we go forward. The question I need to ask you, the first volume, that's out in trade paperback now?
Yes, it is. It's been out for about a month, and it's funny. I think it reads better as a trade. When we initially released the first 7 issues of Genrise, we actually had a solo issue about the alien Lahusid Brim. Mm-hmm. And that was not included in the trade because I felt that it would be better for the readers to have that in the second volume because, as you mentioned, the end of the first trade is a really nice ending point for us. So that will actually be in the next trade. Mm-hmm. But the trade is out right now, and we've gotten a really, really positive response from a lot of readers. I've actually talked to people even in the film industry, James Berardinelli, who's the best online film critic in America, according to the late Roger Ebert, said that this story would compare to the best of the summer blockbusters that we've seen over the last 10, 15 years. He's loved Genrise, and he's been a big fan. Ain't It Cool News did a wonderful piece on us. We were featured in Rolling Stone magazine. And interestingly enough, Middle East Film and Comic Con in Dubai is where we premiered the series. And I was working with the directors of that event. That's actually how this all started. I was working with the directors of that event, helping them get some guests together. And that took place in Dubai in 2012. And I was working on Genrise without their knowledge. And I said, you know, this might be a nice place to introduce this series to sort of give back to the region that sort of spawned the story. And I showed it to the directors of that event, and they were blown away by it. And they actually said, we want to use the characters from Genrise in the official branding of the event. And that was last year.
Wow.
And then they used the characters again this year in 2013. And actually, when I came back from the event in 2012, that's when IDW approached us. And I have to say, Chris Ryle and the team over there is just they're just amazing. They're so wonderful to work with, and they were the ones that gave Genrise a chance because this is the first series in the history of the comics medium to be based on Middle Eastern themes. I know there's a new Miss Marvel that's going to be introduced next year by Marvel, but this is the first story ever that was a regular ongoing series or miniseries that was based on Middle Eastern characters. You know, there have been characters here and there, but this was the first time ever, and I have to give them a lot of credit. It's not a Middle Eastern story, but it's based on Middle Eastern themes, and it's something that's never been done before. So Chris Ron, those guys, I give them so much credit, you know, for working with us. But that's how it all started. Thanks to the Middle Eastern Film and Comic Con, and, you know, the response there, we were able to move forward. And like I said, hopefully we'll be able to tell other stories because this is just scratching the surface as far as we're concerned.
That's great. See, that always makes me feel good when you have more stories to tell and you're kind of building, you know, laying the building blocks for other things that are going to come in the future. I always like that.
Thanks.
Now, did this come out individual issues or is it first seen in America in a trade?
No, it actually premiered in January of this year. The issues are all, I think you can probably still order those from Diamond or if you contact your local comic retailer. It's a monthly series. Mm-hmm. And then the issue 9 and 10 will wrap up the initial series, and the story will go on. And what we hope to do actually as we move forward is actually to tell Jin stories in the past, in the present, in the future. So we actually hope to tell Jin anthology stories. So we're going to have different writers telling different Jin stories that take place in the past, that take place in the far future. So the sky's the limit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I noticed that Volume 2, is, according to Amazon, is going to be released on April 8 in 2014.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's when you'll collect the rest of the issues that are coming out.
Yeah, definitely. And the last issue is going to be a little bit longer. It's going to be, I think, about 25 pages in length. And it wraps up, you know, pretty much everything that we've worked on up to this point. And, you know, we're really excited about that. And one thing I also want to know is there's another interesting character we're hopefully going to be telling stories about in the future as well, and that's Haya. Mm-hmm. Who is the female protagonist in this story. We really don't have that much information about her in this story. She's almost the equivalent of, you know, some of the one of the, she's all, I want to call her, I guess you could say, she's a – let's just put it this way. We've scratched the surface with her, but there's a lot more to tell, and we're hopefully going to be telling stories with her and the female Jin character in the future. So they're going to be sort of the dynamic duo in the future with respect to other stories. So
wow. Wow. I can see this could go on for quite a long time, and I'm happy to hear that.
We're hopeful that it will. And so far, this response has been great. And, you know, I can't talk too much about this right now, but I will say this, that there has been a significant amount of interest with respect to other mediums of storytelling as well, not just comics as far as Jinrai is concerned. And hopefully by the time the trade hits next year, we're going to have some really, really exciting announcements because, yeah, I mean, there's some exciting discussions going on behind the scenes that I think I think getting on the Jin train now is a good idea. Let me just put it that way.
Well, you know, you were hinting towards something else, maybe movies, maybe TV or something going on. I was going to ask you about that, but, you know, I'd rather wait until we get something official. But I'm glad to hear that you're thinking about other ways of bringing the Jinrise universe to people.
Yeah, there's, like I said, I can't go into the details mm-hmm. with respect to those yet, and you'll be one of the first that we talk to about this, but I can tell you that there are some quite exciting things going on behind the scenes, and, you know, we've had zombie stories, we've had vampire stories for so long. I think it's time for Jin stories and other mediums, don't you?
Oh, I agree. I'm all ready for it because I think this is a great story. It's great characters, lots of action, lots of things. You're actually teaching a lot of us stuff, which I always like. I miss those days back in the early days of the Justice League of America. They used to teach us science, for example. And now I'm learning about a different culture that I don't know much about, and I like that. There's nothing I don't want to learn about, and so this to me is just great. I love to find out more about these things.
Thanks. And like I said, at the end of the day, I really hope that what readers take away is that this is a global story about all of us, that, you know, whether you're from, like I said, the Middle East, whether you're from Australia, New Zealand, whether you're from South America, wherever you're from, I hope that they can relate to the characters. And that's the most important thing, because I think the strongest characters are the characters that we, regardless of wherever we're from, the characters that we can relate to, those are the strongest characters. And, you know, my goal ultimately as we move forward with Jubble Entertainment, which is the company that actually was founded to tell stories based on or inspired by other cultures, that we tell stories not just with respect to Middle Eastern tales, but stories from other parts of the world as well. We want to tell stories inspired by Malaysian themes. We want to tell stories based on Russian themes. We want to tell stories inspired by Indian themes. Our goal is to basically tell stories inspired by the classics or the cultural standards or mores from those parts of the world, but do it with the flair that has been embraced by global audiences today. So I'm a big fan of Western comic book storytelling, and I'm a big fan of Western filmmaking. And my goal going in was to make sure that our stories were inspired by other parts of the world, but reflected or were endemic of the storytelling standards that we find here in the West today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was gripped. I speak for myself. I was reading along, man. It just flew.
Thanks.
And so for me, I want to see more. I can't wait for the other. I'm going to go after individual issues because I don't think I can wait for the next trade. So I'm going to be after that. So it's good stuff, and I'm glad you're doing good things. Is there anything else that you're working on besides you're mentioning possible stories from other cultures and stuff? But I imagine Jinrise kind of keeps you pretty busy.
Yeah, well, it's funny because at the second Middle East Film and Comic Con, we introduced our second series. It was actually an issue zero there. It was called Drawn, and it was actually written by an Emirati writer. And it's a fascinating series. It's about this young woman who has gained mysterious powers through the power of henna.
Mm-hmm.
So she is doing an amazing job with that. We're actually going to have the first issue completed, the first official issue completed by Middle East Film and Comic Con in 2014, which will hopefully be April. Then we have a wonderful series that's due for release also next year called Blades of Hope. And Blades of Hope actually is about six martial artists from different parts of the world who are all female leads. And it's written by a young woman by the name of Paige Hartman.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually geared towards, I don't want to say it's geared towards women, but it's written for women. A lot of mm-hmm. comics are written by men for men, or they're written by women for men.
Yeah,
but our series is actually written for women, and we really wanted to make sure that these were very strong protagonists, and they were characters that women could relate to. I'm good friends with Ashley Eckstein, who was the voice actress behind Ahsoka Tano on Star Wars, the Clone Wars animated series, and she has a company called Her Universe, and it's mm-hmm. geared towards female sci-fi fans. And what she told me once was that she spoke to so many fans at all the conventions she visited over the last 3 or 4 years, and she would say 95% of the female fans who came up to her said that they were not interested in characters who were pretty, who were, you know, sexy, who were known for their physical attributes. They said that the most important things that they wanted to see in their characters or the characters they related to were courage, you know, inner strength, intelligence, and these characters in Blades of Hope are going to reflect that. They're going to be the complete antithesis of the sexualized characters that we find so often in comic books today. And so I think it's going to be really, really something exciting for not just comic fans, but for people who have never picked up a comic as well. So we have two series on the horizon, and one that we hope to continue telling in Genrise.
Great. Well, boy, I wish you a lot of success going forward. If you ever, when you talk to Mr. Liss next time,
yes,
tell him I said hi, because he may remember me from when I interviewed him before.
But
man, you got so much good stuff coming out, man. You're going to get all my money if you keep this up. So.
Well, you know,
pretty good.
Well, I appreciate that, and like I said, I hope that at the end of the day that the people who do pick up Genrise begin to tell their own stories. I think that mm-hmm. the one thing that I really hope that that readers take away is that storytelling is universal.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in Southwest Virginia. I live outside of Philadelphia. I grew up in the coal mining region of Southwest Virginia. And there have been people who picked up Genrise. And I said, the one thing I would love people to do after picking up Genrise is I'd love to see a hero or some myth that came or was inspired by by the people in Southwest Virginia, by their stories. So what I hope ultimately happens is that people who pick up Genrise are people who have never even thought about telling a story, and they say, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and tell my story. I'm going to tell a story inspired by the things that I'm familiar with, the things that are part of my cultural heritage or my history. And that's ultimately what I'd love to see. So more important than your money, Wayne, I'd love to see you tell your own story. So if you can do that and promise me you'll do that in some way, form, or fashion, I'll be very, very satisfied.
Okay. Well, we'll see what we can do about that in the future. But so it's great to talk with you, and keep up the successful work. And, man, I can't wait to read your next book.
Thanks, Wayne. And anytime you'd love to have us on, we'll always be available. And thanks for your support. And, again, just remember, the game of life is about all of us, wherever we are, wherever we're from.
Let's talk a little bit about the latest news. DC recently released their solicitations for February 2014, and there's some interesting points to bring out about it. For example, Lois Lane gets a one-shot. They talk about the fact that it's her 75th anniversary, too, as well as Superman's. So look for Superman : Lois Lane #1, the one-shot, and it'll give her some focus and some time in this anniversary as well. Then Olmec is back in Suicide Squad. I liked that book when it was out from Keith Giffen back at the beginning of the New 52. Nice to see the character come back. Batman, Superman, and World's Finest crossover. That'll be between the books Batman, Superman, and then World's Finest. So you're going to get Superman, Batman, Huntress, and Power Girl involved. So that'll be an interesting book coming out in February. The Trinity Together is in Superman Unchained. That'll be an interesting book with Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman in there taking on some nasties. There are reveals in Forever Evil. That'll be out in February. Cyborg makes his comeback along with the Metal Men in the Justice League book. And we haven't seen them very much. And then also Forever Evil Blight sees four issues coming out that month, as well as a surprising turn of the Sea King, Aquaman's crime syndicate counterpart, on the side of the Justice League Dark. Then we have Gothtopia rolling out throughout the Bat books. Brian Buccioletto and Francis Manapul are coming to Detective Comics soon, but Mr. Layman is going to wrap up his run on Detective Comics, and what a great run it has been, by the Gothtopia story. So be sure to pick that up, Detective Comics, in February. I'd still get it before that, too. Then there's a Holiday Harley, a Harley story with Amanda Connor, Jimmy Palmiotti, and Chad Harden talking about the villainous on Valentine's Day. Should be interesting. It reminds me of the Mad Love story that Paul Dini and Bruce Timm did, both on the television and in a comic. So it'll be an interesting story. Harley is always a crazy character. Then Batgirl gets a boost in the movement. Since Batgirl's not going to be in Gothtopia, she's going to be into a different Gail Simone book in February, and that's going to be the Movement number 9. So wait and see what happens with that. I always like the Batgirl character. Then Kid Flash is the newest teen hero turned villain. In Teen Titans number 28, Kid Flash goes to war with his former teammates over the future he wants to rule. So we'll see how that goes. And finally, Black Canary is leading the way in Injustice. The second year of Injustice, which is based, of course, on the popular video game, is going to be with Black Canary in charge instead of Batman for at least one issue. The solicitation also teased that the story is expanding much farther beyond the Injustice Earth, answering the question of what all those other alien races in the DC Universe think of the despot version of Superman. You should be able now to find Man of Steel in your local store or for download, and I really loved that Superman movie, and I hope you'll get it. Then there's an interesting little news story from Dynamite, in which we have the people who had been working on Tiny Titans for DC now switch over, and they do a book called Little Battlestar Galactica. It's going to have Art Baltazar and Franco Aureliani are going to be taking over a kid's version of Battlestar Galactica. That's going to be kind of interesting, because Battlestar Galactica has often been a really morose show, of course, with Ronald E. Moore in charge. It wasn't quite in the early days. We'll see how that turns out. I'm going to be interested to see if this actually draws the attention of a lot of kids. So I'll be fascinated to see how that book rolls out. And finally, the last story to talk about is one that kind of makes me choke up every once in a while. In San Francisco, there is a child called Miles, who is now been nicknamed Bat Kid. And what he does is he goes around and fights the Riddler and the Penguin, even though he's only a 5-year-old cancer-stricken boy. Of course, this is all being done by Make-A-Wish Foundation. And wherever he goes, there's a flood of camera people trying to take pictures with him and stuff like that. And it just kind of chokes me up. It's great that this child, you know, his cancer currently is in remission, I understand, that he gets his wish fulfilled like this is just a great thing. He has his own Batmobile. He gets a personal call from the police chief, Greg Sewer, for help. And all kinds of wonderful things going on. This is what Make-A-Wish is all about, and I just love this story. I hope you see about it on the television, because it's all over the place right about now, and I just think this is a great thing. And that's the news for this week. Let's have a look at the books that are coming out this Wednesday, November 20. From Dark Horse, Brain Boy number 3 hits the stands, which is a good one. I wrote a review of that on a different website, and it's a pretty good book. So I hope you're reading it. It's a very good thing, and this is the conclusion of the very first story arc. So read Brain Boy number 3 from Dark Horse. I think it's a great one. From DC, we get Animal Man number 25, always a good book. Batman 66, number 5, written by Jeff Parker. Batman and Two-Face, number 25. Batman Beyond Universe, number 4, always a good book. Then we get Batman Detective Comics hardcover volume 3, Emperor Penguin, and the trade paperback of the same book called Scare Tactics. Then there's Batwoman 25, Birds of Prey, number 25, Forever Evil Rogues Rebellion, number 2, Green Lantern New Guardians, number 25. Then there's Harley Quinn, number 0, for $2.99. That'll be interesting to see. I always liked that character from Batman the Animated Series. There's also He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, number 8. Red Hood and the Outlaws, number 25. And we get Supergirl, 25. The Wake, number 5, by Scott Snyder. Always like that. And Wonder Woman, number 25. Now, one of the things I didn't mention were which ones are zero-year tie-ins, and that's Birds of Prey, 25, and Red Hood and the Outlaws this week. There's a very interesting statue in the collectibles from DC coming out, and boy, and this is going to be one I think I'm going to have to go after. Batman Black and White statue by Greg Capullo, the artist on Batman currently. Must be good. Great, 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 great stuff. We get to IDW, and we get to Ben 10, number 1, of course, based on the Cartoon Network series. Doctor Who, Prisoners of Time, number 12. I interviewed Sahib earlier, and Gen Rise, number 8, is going to be out this week, so be sure to pick that up. And also get the trade if you can. There's also Samurai Jack from IDW Publishing, which is very good. I love that cartoon. From Image, we get Clone number 12 and a second printing of Ghosted number 4. In Marvel, we get Daredevil number 33 by Mark Waid. Indestructible Hulk number 15 by Mark Waid. Tokyo 2 graphic novel hardcover, $16.99, that has Michael Oeming involved with it. Very good book. From other comic companies, we get Atomic Robo Real Science Adventures, number 12. And hopefully we'll get Atomic Robo Savage Sword of Dr. Dinosaur, number 3. Unfortunately, what often happens is that one of these gets delayed when they've got two in the schedule. So I hope one will be out. And I'd like for two, them both to be out. That would be great fun. We get NBC's Grimm, number 7 from Dynamite. We also get the hardcover version of the Ghoul Goblin story for Jim Butcher's Dresden Files. Mysterious Strangers by Chris Robertson at number 6 is out. Rachel Rising, number 21, will be out. The Shadow 19 also will be out. I always like that original character. Then we also get Warlord of Mars, number 29. And everything wraps up with Exo Manowar, number 19, from Valiant. Good stuff all. Those are the books that will be out this Wednesday, November 20th. And that's a wrap for this episode. Be back next time when I'll have more news, interviews, reviews, and previews. But until then, keep reading your comics.